You are listening to The Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. In today's fixation with the war on terror, can an academic at an American university support resistance in Iraq? Dr. Yunus Parsa Benab is professor of political science at Stryer University in Washington, D.C. He's an author and editor of Iran Bulletin. At the Vancouver Public Library on January 8, 2007, Dr. Benab explained the neocon plans for world domination and the right to resist. Dr. Benab argues that after World War II, the elite and large corporations that they owned in America were prepared for a plan of world domination. They would like to have bases all over the world and to expand their corporations to dominate business all over the world, but they were unable to do so because they were opposed by the Soviet Union and the expansion of communism, by the development of social democracy in Europe, and also by national liberation movements in many countries of the world. But, he says, by about 1991, conditions changed so that a group of intellectuals, perhaps only 25 in number, who came into various positions of public power by appointment and also occupied places in think tanks, and they were called the neocons, could propose a plan where America would continue its original idea of dominating the world. Here are some of the reasons why that became possible.
The number one was, in 1991, Soviet Union collapsed and broke down into 15 independent but very weak, corrupt, chaotic countries. So that one obstacle disappeared. By 1991, we see and we witness fall and decline of what we called national liberation movements. They disappeared too, or at least they were weakened. Maybe in historical perspective, you can see the death of Yasser Arafat 2 years ago was the end of that era, which worldwide it was called national liberation movements. And the third obstacles started dwindling and disappearing. That was fall and decline of social democracies in Europe. So now we are in 1991, 1992, and United States is observing and United States is witnessing the fact that those three obstacles that prevented U.S. to globalize Monroe Doctrine, those three factors had completely disappeared. So United States is emerging as a unipolar country, a superpower without any challenge. But add to that another factor, rise of a specific group of people in American politics that today they are called neoconservatives or neocons. So now United States has four important reasons to go back and say now is a good time all over the world for the U.S. to globalize Monroe Doctrine, which I will explain how they describe globalization of Monroe Doctrine in their literature. So you have collapse of Soviet Union, you have collapse of national liberation movements, and you have collapse of social democratic or social democracies in Europe, and the rise of not new class, but new elites, new group of people, as we call them, and they themselves call themselves, neoconservatives. So with the neoconservatives in power, once they took over the White House in the year 2000, then immediately they said, now is the time for the U.S. to push forward and advance its project in terms of globalizing Monroe Doctrine. What do they mean by globalizing Monroe Doctrine? Remember, Monroe Doctrine was saying that Latin America is U.S. backyard. No world power can intervene in the affairs of Latin American countries without consent and advice and support of United States. Now, they globalize that one. That means United States is going to make five major strategic areas of the world like Latin America. That means aside, beside Latin America, there will be five major areas in the world that they are strategically are very, very important. They are vital. And they should be backyard of the U.S. So out of that five major strategic areas, U.S. naturally selected or opted the Middle East. So Middle East is number one important strategic, geopolitical, geopolitically strategic important area that the U.S. would like to have hegemony in that area. Why the Middle East? Why not Southeast Asia? Why not Caribbean area, which are very, very important geopolitically important strategic areas? They are, but the Middle East is number one, which I'm going to give you couple of at least a couple of important reasons why U.S. considers Middle East a very important strategic area. You look at the map, you will see that the whole Middle East is a buffer zone or connecting area, connecting vast land of three important continents, Africa, Asia, and Europe, is connected to each other through the Middle East. That is strategically very important, not only now, but throughout history. In other words, Middle East was always strategically important to world powers, to Ottoman Empire, to British Empire. Before Ottoman Empire and British Empire, if you go to almost Middle Ages and before Middle Ages, Roman Empire, always Middle East was connecting point between China and India, African countries, and Europe through Silk Road. If you look at the map, you will see that Middle East played very important role during that period. So, Middle East is strategically very important to the United States. But that is only in terms of its location. How about other factors that makes Middle East very important? Neocons have a very new definition of what they call Middle East. You see, our concept of Middle East is very different from their concept and their understanding of Middle East. To us, Middle East means Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Iran, Jordan, Iraq, Syria, United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain. That is to us, Cyprus, that is Middle East. Whether you are liberal, conservative, or radical, usually you accept that one as a Middle East. Neocons have a different understanding and concept of the Middle East. First of all, they call it New Middle East, sometimes they call it Great Middle East. What they mean by that? The Middle East that we understand, plus Central Asian countries of Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, plus Caucasian republics of Armenia, Georgia, and Azerbaijan. To them, that is New Middle East. So, when they say Middle East is number one strategically important area in the world, you have to understand how they define Middle East under the rubric of New Middle East. If you accept that one, that definition, then you will understand that 85% of world natural gas is located in the New Middle East. and very close to 72 or 71% of world energy resources, oil, is located in the New Middle East. So neocons believe that it is almost impossible to globalize Monroe Doctrine unless you have what? Oil hegemony in that Middle East. Once a power, a major power, imperial power, has oil hegemony in that area, then that power can dictate its policies to its friends and enemies as well as its allies. Today, here and there, we see opposition to U.S. foreign policy by certain number of countries in Europe. France, Germany, just to give you examples, and recently Italy and Spain. These countries are opposing the U.S. sometimes, not always. Why are they capable of opposing the U.S.? Because U.S. does not have complete hegemony over the oil. But once U.S. has that complete hegemony over the oil, these countries that are sometimes opposing the U.S. about Iraq, about Cuba, about many, many other topics, including Lebanon, then these allies and these U.S. friends and allies will not be able to challenge the United States or oppose the United States or disagree with the United States. They know it. Jacques Chirac knows that if U.S. takes over completely the Middle East, then France will have no choice but to accept U.S. hegemony, because France needs every bit of oil coming from Middle East. France is not Russia. Russia does not need Middle Eastern oil. But France needs. China needs Iranian oil, Iraqi oil, and oil from the Middle East. But not Putin's Russia. So that's a very, very important aspect of neocons' move to dominate and achieve and maintain oil hegemony in the Middle East. Now, once U.S. is capable of doing it, then U.S. will dictate its policies on her own allies and friends, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, and so on and so forth. From there on, then U.S. can move in direction of what we, in political science, we call castration of Russia. Because Russia will be a major obstacle to United States. Russia does not have to listen to U.S. when U.S. dictates Russia. Because Russia has enough natural resources, but including mainly oil and natural gas. But Russia is very weak compared to the United States militarily. So in order for United States to contain China, then U.S. has to castrate major powers like India, Brazil, and Russia. And from there on, then United States will have only one more step to take to contain China, if there is an opposition from China, to dismember China through Uyghuristan, Xinjiang, or Tibet, to completely dismember. And then from there on, United States can claim that they have galvanized globalization of Monroe Doctrine. I would say, when we sit down and study statements coming from China, we understand that Chinese leadership, they are more aware about this move than all of us. They know it. Their intelligence forces, their research forces, all of them are directing attention in this direction, that what U.S. is doing in the Middle East is not simply to take over the Middle East. That is not the goal. Goal is to contain China. Goal is, before containing China, castrate countries like India, Brazil, and Russia, and then contain China. So within that context, I would say that the importance of Middle East comes to our attention. I will give you a couple of other important points about why Middle East is so important. As I mentioned, Middle East is an area that connects three continents to each other. Middle Easterners have historical relationship with African countries. Middle Easterners have historical relations with Europe and Asia. Just simply take one country in the Middle East, Iran. You will see that Iranians connect Soviet civilization, Arab civilization, to Indian civilization. This applies to a good number of countries. Distance-wise, and then in terms of human resources or human labor. So United States has a plan in the Middle East under the name of what they call New Middle East or Greater Middle East or Great Middle East.
You are listening to the Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Dr. Yunus Parsa Benab is professor of political science at Stryer University in Washington, D.C.
But Great Middle East has certain dialectical relationship with what neocons call Greater Israel. How do they connect these two? They divide Middle East into three portions. One, Middle Eastern countries can provide labor force to United States. Countries like Saudi Arabia, including Iran, Egypt, they can provide a lot of labor force, human resources. So Middle East is divided into three areas. Area that provides labor, an area that provides not labor but tremendous amount of natural resources, energy resources. And that's specifically Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia, and Kazakhstan. All these four countries can provide huge amount of natural resources. So that's the second area. And the third area is the area that's called an area which will provide to that Middle East in their project, technology and science, and that's Israel. So there is a relationship between New Middle East or Great Middle East with the Great Israel. In the literature of neocons, in the context of what I just explained about American foreign policy and the main points of American foreign policy in the Middle East, I'm going to come up with a couple of points that may be clarifying our minds about the importance of the Middle East. United States is not invading Iraq or maybe invading Iran in the future, in the next 2 years or 3 years, for the purpose of taking over Middle East as a goal. No. Neocons use the word calling station. It's like a springboard, a jumping ground. Middle East is going to be used as a jumping ground to push U.S. foreign policy project in terms of globalizing Monroe Doctrine. So the purpose is not just simply changing regime and Iraq and taking over those countries. Their goal is using those countries in order to create a huge jumping ground. From there, they can jump into Europe and dictate their policies, and from there on, castrate Russia, and finally contain China, and declare what? World hegemony. This is the project that the neocons have in their literature. Where do I get these information? Where are my sources? My sources are coming from three important areas. Number one is a political literature of neocons themselves. Neoconservatives are very, very prolific and very active. Each one of these 25 intellectuals or elites that we call them neocons, good number of them are working for U.S. government, and some of them are not working for U.S. government. They are out of U.S. government, working in those think tanks, supporting U.S. foreign policy project. If you read their literature, then you can get a lot of information about their mentality, about their views, about future of the world, future of the Middle East, and even future of the United States and Western world. So I usually read their literature by picking up two important sources that they provide weekly and monthly. The one that is monthly is called National Review. It's published in New York every month by neocons. Neocons that are working within the government, neocons that are outside of the government. The second important source is Weekly Standard, which is published again in New York, but it's weekly. And good number of neocons, they write in those two major newspapers, in fact, major periodicals rather than newspapers. And my second major source away from neoconservatives are Middle Eastern newspapers, but especially newspapers published in Istanbul. One of the most important independent newspapers today published in Istanbul that you can get a lot of information about the Middle East and neocons project is a well-known newspaper, Akşam, which is in English will be evening. Akşam is a newspaper published in Istanbul weekly, and it in efficiency and its in competence, it can rival with all of those periodicals that neocons are putting out. Akşam gives you a lot of information about U.S. policy implementation in the Middle East, in fact, in the greater Middle East. So Akşam writes a lot of articles about American military presence in Kazakhstan, in Turkmenistan, in Kyrgyzstan, and then United States occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. So those are my second sources that I read them, and I become more familiar with neocons' understanding of this world, neocons' nature of how they sit down and plan for the future of our world. And the third sources are newspapers that are published in the United States, mainly Washington Post. There are a good number of individuals that they write for Washington Post that they have very direct and friendly relationship with neocons. And New York Times comes after, probably, Washington Post, very important, and alternative media in the United States. I'll give you two important sources that if you really like to know what's happening in the United States and you don't want to listen to Washington Post or New York Times or CNN or Fox News, then you can use them as a good source for classroom instruction, for lectures, for presentation, for better understanding of what neocons are saying. One of them is called Monthly Review. It's a Marxist publication published in New York monthly, and then great number of people that they write for Monthly Review are the ones that they do come up with a good set of critique of New Kant's understanding of this world, New Kant's philosophy, specifically in connection with clash of civilizations, and their understanding of the future. The concept of last man or global man. So Monthly Review writes about New Kant from a very, very critical point of view. Another one, Monthly Review is monthly, but the other one that comes weekly is called the Nation magazine. Has been in the United States, published in the United States for the last 125 years. And it's published in New York, like most of those periodicals. You can use them as a very important sources to study more about New Kant and their project for the Middle East. Now I will give you another point, and then I will kind of finish my presentation. And that is, how do I see, after reading these literature, how do I see the future? Number one, United States is now head of what we call world system of capital. You know, imperialism. United States is the head. But this empire, whatever you call this empire or world system of capital, is going through a major stage of crisis, but specifically in economic area. U.S. now is a country which produces nothing, only consumes a lot. World produces, United States consumes. In 1945, 50% of what you were wearing, what you were eating, and what were you seeing came from United States. Today, surely what you are eating, what you are seeing, what you are using, what you are wearing, are owned by the U.S. But they are not produced in the United States. They are produced outside of the U.S. So world produces, United States consumes. U.S. is in debt. Its balance of payment is in shambles. Balance of trade, even with countries like India. U.S. buys more from India that India buys from United States. That's balance of trade. That means buying and selling of goods and services. United States is behind even India. But then the question is, why United States is in debt, but when your country is in debt, international debt, then what will happen to that country? Naturally, if your country is Iran or Egypt or the Philippines, you will be in trouble. But United States is the only military power today in the world. I borrow a lot of money from you. Now, when you ask me to give back your money, I say I'm not going to give you your money, and if you talk too much, I will bomb hell out of you. It's a military power. So, if China cannot do anything, the Chinese know that they cannot encounter U.S. militarily. And politically, Chinese are in trouble too, at home. China of the year 2007 is not China of 1960s.
You are listening to The Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Dr. Yunus Parsa Benab is Professor of Political Science at Strayer University in Washington, D.C.
So, competition goes on. So there is a good possibility, 10 years from now, that you will see that our world will witness another major imperialist war, specifically, most probably, between China and United States. possibility is there. You can talk about its probability, but possibility is there that China is emerging as a major power. But what type of a power? A power that will look like United States. Maybe 10 years from now, we will sit down and say that, China and United States are like Siamese twins. If you slap one, the other one will cry. If you tickle one, the other one will laugh. They are so much alike. In their domestic policies, as well as in their foreign policies. Remember, foreign policy is a reflection of domestic policy. At this point, elimination of civil liberties in the United States. Qualitatively is not different from what American military forces are doing in Iraq. Not very different. You think that Abu Ghraib is the only major prison where Americans torture. Mm-mm. Come to Louisiana and Texas. You will be surprised. As my black colleagues always tell me, that what you will see in jails of Texas will make Abu Ghraib picnic, to look like a picnic. What Chinese are doing with their own people? Producing 40% of American shoes, paying their workers only 20 cents a day. Dumping their shoes into Chicago, Detroit, other major cities, selling those shoes for more than $60 a pair, and paying their workers only 20 cents a day in China. That is China's domestic policy. But what do they do abroad? Go and ask people of Sudan, Darfur. Crimes that Chinese are committing in Darfur is not different qualitatively from crimes that United States is committing in Iraq. Except we as people of Canada, Iranians, Indians and Chinese, we know about crimes committed by US in Iraq. But most of us, we have very vague idea what is happening in Darfur. I was talking to a couple of revolutionary intellectuals from Zambia, and they were telling me that in Lusaka, capital of Zambia, majority of students, they believe that their main enemy is not United States, it's China. So Chinese are competing with the United States. They are like Siamese twins. And most probably, or I shouldn't say most probably, but possibly, our world will move forward in direction of another major world war, imperialist war, to what? Divide the world or redivide the world. At least redivide Africa. My last point is that neocons do not believe in redivision of the world anymore. In First World War, Second World War, United States, Great Britain, France, Germany, Japan, they believed in what? Redivision of the world. So that's what they went into war, to redivide the world. They were not satisfied with the status quo. So they went into war. But today, if China and U.S., they go into war in the near future, from neocons' point of view, it will not be redivision of the world. They don't want redivide the world. They want to completely dominate the world. So I will stop my presentation here. Maybe you have some questions or comments to make about what I explained. Thank you.
You are listening to The Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Dr. Yunus Parsa Benab is professor of political science at Stryer University in Washington, D.C. The first question asks how neocons could attack a country which is actually a democracy.
Very true. Neocons have a very, very different concept of what? Democracy. That you and I, we have. Doesn't make any difference whether you are liberal or conservative or radical. You are sharply in complete disagreement with their understanding of democracy. To them, democracy means opening your doors to my market. That is the definition of democracy to them. So, Turkey, if the ruling elites in Turkey, that they have proven to be very, very good allies of the U.S., if they disagree with the U.S., they will face a destiny that otherwise they couldn't if, for example, liberals or conservatives were in power. Liberals and conservatives in the United States, they want you to be dependent on them. But not 100%, maybe 80%. They'll give you 20% of independence. Canada is a good example, right? But neocons don't believe. Even they may at one point disagree with Canadians because Canadians or Canadian government does not agree with the U.S. 100%. They will turn against Canadian government. So Turkey is U.S. ally. But you read the newspaper Akşam, every issue of it brings to our attention that there is a possibility that the United States may attempt to disintegrate Turkey because of Israel and because of Kurdistan in northern part of Iraq. Yeah.
The next question to Dr. Benares asks whether people should resist occupation by a foreign army. Should we support the resistance in Iraq and in Lebanon?
Generally, when I am invited to speak through radio interviews or television appearances or writing articles in the last 3 years, that the idea or possibility and probability of American invasion of Iran, I have taken position that all Iranians, that they like those ideas that they are coming to us from Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1904, 1905, 1906, they should unite against U.S. invasion of Iran. That has been my position. You can read them in my articles and in my internet publishes most of my interviews. That's what I believe. In fact, I believe only a small number of Iranians outside of Iran, very small number of Iranians, they will stand up and say that they approve of American invasion of Iran. Even I will be academically very careful. I would say majority of monarchists, they believe that the U.S. should invade Iran and give them again back their crown, their status, and the prosperity that they used to enjoy. But aside from them, mainly Iranian population people are not in favor of American invasion of Iran. And if they were, now they have been exposed to what is happening, what? To Iraq? And they don't know anything about Darfur, like most of us, but they know about Iraq. Iranians, probably, they know more about Iraq than we do here in Canada and the United States.
Professor Benares also states that China is not much of an alternative to the United States and that they have committed unreported crimes in Darfur.
I think in my presentation last night in Persian language, I gave the explanation. Now I will be glad to give you that. And I hope it will not be boring to some of my Iranian friends that they were last night present. Darfur is a very important region in Sudan. You look at the map, you will see Darfur is a little bit bigger than state of California. But Darfur is rich in good number of areas, but I will only mention two of them. One is oil. Oil in Darfur, only in amount, in quantity, not quality, in quantity, is more than total amount of oil produced today in the United States in what we call southwestern state of United States, Texas, Arizona, Oklahoma, New Mexico. These are oil states in the United States. They provide every oil consumed in the United States that is not imported in the United States. That's coming from the United States. Darfur has more oil than these four states. However, oil in Darfur enjoys high quality grade point. From point of view of those individuals that they are expert on oil studies, high quality grade point means when you are using oil for, let's say, for airplane to travel, especially non-stop flights, the amount of sulfur left after oil is burned will dictate whether your oil is enjoying high quality grade point or low quality grade point. So here we are. If I find out that United is using Canadian oil to take me from here to Washington nonstop, I will decide to stay in Vancouver. I will never go. Because Canadian oil is very important for heating, but not for non-stop flights. That applies to good number of oil producing countries. Nigeria is number one in high quality oil. Kuwait is number two. Iran and Iraq, they come in number three and number four. Darfur apparently is almost topping every country except Iraq in high quality oil. Now that is only oil, but Darfur has diamond. I know most of you have heard about De Beer Company. De Beer Company is a multinational corporation, buys and sells 75% of diamonds that we are using today all over the world. So De Beer is very active there. But Chinese are moving into Africa, any area in Africa that provides tremendous oil, extraction of oil, discovery of oil. Chinese move into that area. They help the government, they support the government, they work with the government, and they, in fact, supply weapons for those governments. So people in Darfur are dying. We have to see what type of weapons are killing these people of Darfur, children, I mean, mainly. So you will be amazed to see that Chinese weapons are being used, like Iraq. American weapons are being used in Iraq, killing simple children. Okay, so I take your comment. I think you are right in saying that Chinese soldiers are not in Darfur. Huh? But remember, for many, many years, at the beginning of Vietnam War, American soldiers were not apparent. They were not visible. Special forces were there, active, working, but not American soldiers.
And who are the neocons?
You mean Donald Rumsfeld's resignation? Very good point. You see, when, as I mentioned, our world or world system of capital is going through crisis, this crisis is reflected in factional fighting within the ruling elites. Rumsfeld was kind of a scapegoat. when it came to the clash, one faction gave concession to other faction. Immediately after November the 7th, when great number of Americans honorably, heroically, they took into streets and voted against neocons, voted against the war, then the system, the regime, sacrificed one of its lambs, and Donald Rumsfeld was one of them. But is it going to affect the war? No, neocons are in charge. Remember, Donald Rumsfeld is not a new con. He's not a new con. Donald Rumsfeld, like Condoleezza Rice, they work for neocons. Neocons that they theorize the concept of world hegemony are those 25 individuals working for the government or outside the government. Paul Wolfowitz, who is now the head of World Bank, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, Michael Ledham, these are top-notch neocons.
Would you resist if your country was invaded?
Okay. Now, let me only focus on Iraq, and then I'll go to Lebanon and focus on those two issues, okay? You see, I always believe as teacher, as an individual, as an Iranian, I believe that every country, people of any country, people of every country, they have a right to resist occupation. That is my belief. And I know 100% that if, for example, Russians or any other country, if they invade and occupy Vancouver, I am sure people of Vancouver will resist occupation. So, Iraqis are resisting American occupation. Within that resistance, there are many, many different Iraqis. Resistance is not a political party. Resistance is not a front. Resistance is a process. Process opposing occupation. So, am I supporting Iraqi resistance against U.S. occupation? Yes. Wholeheartedly, honestly, I do. The way I supported French resistance against German occupation of Paris. I historically believe Charles de Gaulle was hero that time in resisting German occupation, fascist German occupation of Paris and other parts of France. So I give the same credit to resistance in Iraq. So naturally, I support resistance in Iraq. Now, the second part. Are there individuals, groups within resistance that ideologically, politically, culturally, I disagree with them? 100%. I support Iranian Constitution of 1904. I always did. Every year, I have a presentation in honor of anniversary of Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1904-1905, because Iranians were the first people in the Middle East that they made successful Constitutional Revolution. Surely that revolution was later on defeated, but it was successful for at least 2 years at the beginning, and it went forward for 16 years. So did I support Iranian Constitutional Revolution of 1904? Yes. Was within Iranian Constitutional Revolutionaries individuals that 100% I disagreed with them? Yes. So we go to Lebanon now. Israelis invaded Lebanon with prepared plan by neocons. They invaded Lebanon. Am I supporting resistance of Lebanon against occupation? 100%, I do. Now, within Iraqi and within Lebanese resistance group, there are parties, organizations that necessarily I don't agree with them. Remember, resistance is not a political party. Resistance is not a united front. Resistance is not a front. Resistance is not an organization. Resistance is not an association. Resistance is a process. In every country, when you come and occupy my home, my homeland, my country, after a while there will be a resistance. Now, as a human being, do you believe in the right to resist any occupation? That's what I always believe. I believe that nobody should be sentenced to death. That's my belief. So I believe that Americans and Iraqi government, they committed crime against humanity by killing, by executing Saddam Hussein. Do I disagree with Saddam Hussein? No. As an Iranian especially. Saddam Hussein bombed Tabriz. One of the homes that it was pulverized was my mother's home. I was very happy that she didn't die. But I helped my mom to rebuild her house. And still she's alive, 89 years old. So am I against Saddam Hussein? 100%, even emotionally and personally. But do I believe that they did right in killing Saddam Hussein, executed? No, they were dead wrong. Forget about political ramification of it. That it creates tension between Sunnis and Shiites. That's political even, that which I disagree. Even I didn't believe in capital punishment. I would disagree with execution. So you see how our world is changing, and old ideas, old cliché formulas do not anymore apply to our understanding of world. I support resistance. It doesn't make any difference. I was making a presentation in George Mason University in northern part of Virginia, very close to Washington, D.C. We had the same question. It was beautifully raised the way you raised. So I asked my students, all of them young Northern Virginian students, I said, if Russians, they come and occupy Northern Virginia, would you resist? All of them, they agreed. There is always resistance for us. Now, am I going to support them? Yes. And some people, they will not, including inside Iraq. They were certain individuals at the beginning that they did not support resistance, and they supported occupation, and still they support occupation. So life goes on this way.
And finally, Professor Benares says, some corporations will profit from the chaos in Iraq and the Middle East.
United States is in quagmire in Iraq. United States has not been able to subdue Iraq. On the other hand, as I explained, U.S. is facing a very, very deep down crisis, especially economic crisis, as a world power, as a head of world system of capital. So under this condition, U.S. would invade Iran. Very logical, right? But remember, your logic and my logic is very different from Newcomb's logic. They have a very, very different logic today in the world. You have to understand at least their logic. You see, to us, for example, Carter, President Carter, his famous book, right? That recently, very controversial. He believes in what? Making profit. As a farmer, very advanced farmer, peanut farmer, capitalist, he wants to make what? Profit. To him, his logic, which you and I understand, as far as there is peace in Iraq, he will sell what? More peanuts. Right? But Rumsfeld would like to have a war because Rumsfeld belongs to a multinational corporation that they only make weapons. That's very simple, isn't it? Now, however, neocons, they don't believe peaceful conditions, peaceful era to make more profit. They believe that their capitalism can accumulate more money, more wealth through chaos. In fact, their project sometimes, I call it globalization of Monroe Doctrine. Samir Amin, a well-known political scientist, a Marxist in Africa, in Senegal, he calls their approach empire of chaos. From chaos, they can accumulate more capital. For example, in Iraq, in the last 3-4 years, good number of multinational corporations that they used to be at the bottom of the ranking, now they have come up to number 10, number 11, number... For example, Halliburton, 5 years ago, was number 26 multinational corporation. Today, Halliburton is number 22. In only 3 years, Halliburton accumulated tremendous amount of wealth and capital by providing its services in Iraq. They don't only provide security, they don't only provide weapons, but they provide every scoop of ice cream that American soldiers eat in Iraq. Halliburton provides.
You've been listening to the Local Brown Bagger on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, your radio station. You've been hearing Dr. Yunus Parsa Benab, spelled B-E-N-A-B. He's a professor of political science at Stryer University in Washington, D.C. He's an author and editor of the Iran Bulletin and many books. He's often called on by the media as an expert. He was at the Vancouver Public Library on January 8, 2007, where he explained how the neocons plan for world domination, and he outlined his firm belief in our right to resist.